Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Dorothy Gundy. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, in the U.S. state of Washington, a road called Interstate 90 cuts through a wild, mountainous area to reach the city of Seattle. For the area's many kinds of animals, the busy highway greatly limits their movements. Crossing I-90, as the road is called, is a risky but sometimes necessary act. But soon, animals will have a safer choice for crossing the road. They will be able to go above it. Jen Watkins is with Washington's Conservation Northwest organization. She said, "Everything from an elk down to a small salamander, they need to move to find food, to find mates, to find new places to live as their populations expand or just when conditions change, like a fire breaks out. To help the animals, the state is finishing work on its largest ever wildlife bridge. The 11-meter-tall, 20-meter-wide structure begins in the forest. It forms two arches above the highway, one for each direction of traffic. Workers are adding fencing and plants to help guide the animals across the bridge. 2-meter-thick walls will help block noise from vehicles below. Scientists chose the area because it is within a natural migration path for some animals. At least one animal has already used the bridge. Washington's Transportation Department tweeted that a wildlife camera captured a video of a coyote running over Interstate 90 on the new structure. The agency wrote, "Excited to see what other species cross." The I-90 bridge is part of a growing number of wildlife crossings across the United States. Some are fences, some are overland bridges, and some are underpasses. They all aim to keep drivers and animals away from each other. A 2008 U.S. Transportation Department study found crashes between animals and humans rose year by year. The accidents made up about 5% of all crashes nationally and at the time cost the economy about $8 billion. Such costs come from car repairs, emergency room visits, and removal of the dead animals on roads.
Political cartoons date back to before the creation of the United States. Today, they remain an important part of American culture. They are protected as free speech, as part of a free press, under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Matt Worker is a longtime political cartoonist who won a Pulitzer Prize for his work in 2012. His cartoons appear in Politico, a media company that reports on U.S. politics. He told VOA at his office outside Washington, D.C., that he sees his job as quite unusual.
We're a strange mix of things in that we are making serious commentary on serious topics, but we're doing it not so seriously.
Worker likes the fact that he can express opinions in the same way as television commentators and those who write opinion pieces for newspapers. The difference, he says, is that as a cartoonist, he gets to create silly pictures to get his point across. Worker has seen many changes in the publishing industry over the years. When he started 40 years ago, he says political cartoons appeared as simple black and white images in newspapers. Today, he says, they can be full of many colorful parts, or even animated. Some cartoonists have created whole illustrated stories about political subjects. Such a collection is currently being shown at the museum in Washington. The graphic story is told as a series called Welcome to the New World. It tells of two refugee families from Syria who came to the United States. The cartoon collection, created by Michael Sloan and Jake Halpern, won a 2018 Pulitzer Prize. Patty Rule is vice president of exhibits at the museum. She said museum officials liked what the two award-winning cartoonists were able to create. They did a 20-part series in the New York Times following the story of two Syrian immigrants who fled the war in Syria to come to this country and start a new life with their families. Rule said news-related cartoons have always been an important part of American culture. The country's first political cartoon is generally considered to be one by Benjamin Franklin, a founding father. The cartoon, which showed a snake cut into parts, was published by Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette newspaper in 1754. It was meant to increase support for his plan for a union of Britain's North American colonies. I'm Brian Lynn.
In many industrial countries, people work 5 8-hour days or 40 hours a week. But some companies now want their employees to work just 4 days a week and still pay them for five. Is it too good to be true? Companies that reduced work hours have found that their employees like their jobs more and are more productive at work. Jan Schultz-Hoffen, set up the computer software company Planio in Berlin, Germany. Planio offered a four-day week to its 10-member workforce earlier this year. Schulthoffen said, "It is much healthier, and we do a better job if we're not working crazy hours." In New Zealand, a company called Perpetual Guardian tested how its employees reacted to a 32-hour work week earlier this year. It said the workers reported feeling less pressured and more involved with the business. In Japan, the government is urging companies to let their workers have Monday mornings off. Other attempts to reduce working hours, however, have had little effect, since many Japanese continue to work extra hours anyway. Britain's Trades Union Congress is pushing for the country to move to a four-day week by the end of the century. The group argues that a shorter work week is a way for workers to share in the wealth made by new technologies like machine learning and robotics. The union compared that to the time they won the right to have weekends off during the Industrial Revolution. Tuck's Kate Bell noted, "It would reduce the stress of juggling working and family life and could improve gender equality." Companies that have already tried it say it's better for productivity and staff well-being. Lucy Green is with the marketing communications company J. Walter Thompson. She said, "People are starting to take a step back from the 24-hour digital life we have now and realize the mental health issues from being constantly connected to work." A study of 3,000 employees found that nearly half thought they could easily finish their work in 5 hours a day if they did not have to stop and restart. Many said they already are working more than 40 hours a week anyway. The workers were from 8 countries, including the United States, Britain, and Germany. Dan Schwabel is with Future Workplace, which carried out the survey with Kronos. He observed, "Because you always have the technology, you are always working, so people are getting burned out." Schulthoffen of Planio first tested the four-day work week on himself. He felt the need to slow down after several years of intense work to launch the software company. "I didn't get less work done in 4 days than in 5, because in 5 days, you think you have more time. You take longer," he said. With a 4-day work week, he added, "I have to be quick. I have to be focused if I want to have my free Friday." Schulthoffen added, "We got an unexpected reaction from customers. Most of our clients did not complain. They were just jealous." Dan Schwabel expects more companies and countries will permit a 4-day work week, but not in the United States. He said, "I think America will be the last country to give us Monday mornings off because we're so used to this way of working." I'm Dorothy Gundy.
from VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. President James Madison retired after 8 years in office. His Republican Party chose another Virginian, James Monroe, as its next presidential candidate. The opposition Federalist Party had almost disappeared by the time of the election in 1816. James Monroe easily won the election, but not everyone was happy with the result. After all, Monroe was the fourth president from the state of Virginia. The situation caused hard feelings among political leaders in other areas, especially the states of New England. Monroe sought to improve this situation. He wanted to give the top four jobs in his cabinet to men from each of the nation's four major areas: the Northeast, the South, the West, and the Middle Atlantic coast. But he could find no Westerner who would take the job as head of the War Department. So he had cabinet ministers from only three of the four areas. The West was not represented. Despite the political concerns, most Americans liked Monroe and welcomed his presidency. Historian Harlow Giles Unger has written more than 20 books, including one about James Monroe. Mr. Unger says Monroe was one of America's most beloved presidents. He had been Secretary of State and Secretary of War at the same time under President Madison. He had also been a diplomat under President Thomas Jefferson and helped carry out the Louisiana Purchase, which doubled the size of the country. And Monroe had fought in the Revolutionary War and in the War of 1812.
So Monroe came out of the War of 1812 as a hero, and he and his wife, his beautiful wife Elizabeth, moved into what was a blackened hulk of a presidential mansion. And workers slathered on these thick coats of white paint, and really so thick that it gleamed white.
Harlow Unger says the new president sought to improve the country's safety. Monroe wanted to prevent any more invasions and to extend the country's natural defenses. One of the first problems he faced was in East Florida, in land which is now part of the state of Florida. The area borders the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico. At that time, East Florida belonged to Spain, but Spain controlled only a few towns in the area. The rest was controlled by criminals, escaped slaves, and former British soldiers. The area was also home to Native American Indians of the Seminole and Creek tribes. Sometimes people from East Florida would enter the state of Georgia and attack American citizens. One serious fight involved Seminole Indians and people just across the Georgia border. Monroe ordered General Andrew Jackson to march against the Indians. Jackson was a hero of the War of 1812 against Britain. He sent a message to President Monroe. It said, "Let me know in any way that the United States wants possession of the Florida Territory, and in 60 days it will be done." Jackson received no answer to his letter. He believed the silence meant that he was free to seize Florida. He quickly gathered a force of soldiers and marched toward Florida. General Jackson failed to capture any Indians, but he seized two Spanish towns, St. Mark's and Pensacola. He also arrested two British subjects. The two men were tried by a military court. They were found guilty of spying and giving guns to the Indians. Both were executed. President Monroe called a cabinet meeting as soon as he learned of Jackson's actions. All the ministers, except Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, believed that Jackson had gone too far, but they decided not to denounce him in public. Secretary Adams prepared messages to Britain and Spain about the incidents. His message to Britain carefully stated the activities of the two British subjects in Florida and explained why they were executed. Britain agreed not to take any action. Adams' message to Spain explained the situation this way. Spain had failed to keep the peace along the border as it had promised to do in a treaty. The United States had sent soldiers into Florida only to defend its citizens on the American side. The United States recognized that Florida belonged to Spain, but if Americans were forced to enter Florida again in self-defense, the United States might not return the territory to Spain. Spain had a choice. It could send enough soldiers to keep order in Florida, or it could give Florida to the United States. Spain really had no choice. At that time, Spain's colonies in South America were rebelling. All had declared their independence. José de San Martín led the struggle in Argentina. Bernardo O'Higgins was in Chile. And Simón Bolívar created the Republic of Great Colombia in the north. Spain's forces could not be sent to Florida. They were needed in South America. So the King of Spain agreed to give Florida to the United States. In exchange, the United States agreed to pay $5 million to American citizens who had damage claims against Spain. Historian Harlow Unger says the negotiations with Spain led to more than just Florida. He says President Monroe and Spanish officials also agreed on the boundaries of the Louisiana Purchase. They set the boundaries on the very top of the Rocky Mountains in the central west of the United States. The mountains created a natural border. Mr. Unger says they extended American territory into the northwest edge of the continent to what are now the states of Washington and Oregon. In other words, he says, Monroe moved the American frontier to the Pacific Ocean.
He really stretched the nation into an empire that reached from sea to shining sea.
With the new growth of the nation, tens of thousands of people began moving west. They built houses, started farms, and created towns.
And it was the first time in world history, really, that any sovereign state had granted so much land to people that were not of noble birth. And this expanded the strength of the American population. For the first time now, thousands, tens of thousands of Americans became landowners. With the ownership of land, these people were now, Americans, thousands of them, were now able to vote for the first time, were able to run for office for the first time, and really direct the course of their communities and their nations. It empowered the American people, and they absolutely worshipped Monroe for his efforts.
Harlow Unger says that with the strength and unity of the American people behind him, Monroe could make an important decision about international relations. The issue was the rebelling Spanish colonies in South America. The King of Spain did not want the United States to recognize the colonies' independence, and Spain asked European countries to help it put down the rebellions. Britain wanted no part of the Spanish proposal. It was trading heavily with these new Latin American countries. Spanish or even French control of this area would destroy or limit this trade. So Britain proposed a joint statement with the United States to say that neither country wanted any of Spain's territory in the New World. Britain also wanted the United States to join in opposing the handover of any of Spain's American territories to any other power in Europe. Most of President Monroe's advisors urged him to accept the British offer. Secretary of State Adams opposed it. He did not believe the United States should tie itself to any European power, even Britain. Monroe accepted the advice of his Secretary of State. He included Adams' ideas in his message to Congress in December 1823. This part of the message became known as the Monroe Doctrine. The president said no European power should, in the future, try to establish a colony anywhere in the Americas. He said the political system of the European powers was very different from that of the Americas. Monroe said any attempt to extend this European system to any of the Americas would threaten the peace and safety of the United States. The president also said the United States had not interfered with the colonies of any European power in South America and would not do so in the future. But, Monroe added, a number of these former colonies had become independent countries, and the United States had recognized their independence. We would see it as an unfriendly act, he said, for any European power to try to oppress or control these new American countries in any way. At the same time, Monroe said, the United States never had and never would take part in any war among the European powers. This statement by Monroe was only part of a presidential message to Congress, but it clearly stated one of the most important of America's foreign policies. The country was enjoying a time of good feelings under Monroe, but an old problem was about to return and divide the country again. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA, Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.